the theme for the afternoon talk with you is a wish or endeavor to explore with you one of the most profound questions that a human being can ever ask herself or himself. And the question is, who am I? As small, rather vulnerable sentient creatures on this earth, we find ourselves in a way which we can't explain, of experiencing the fact of having been born. There was no request from us for it. There was no expectation. There was nothing that you and I can recall in which we said, yes, I think I'll be born. And I'll think I'll have these parents, which is most unlikely. In this kind of environment, in this kind of situation, in this place, in this year, in these circumstances, on this particular day, hour, minute and moment. So in some strange way, without any foreplanning whatsoever, you and I and our other, is it 6.7 billion others, brothers and sisters on this planet, all find ourselves alive and living and going through a process from babyhood to childhood to teenagers to 20s to 30s and so on until we get into the salt and pepper club and at the current stage, mostly salt. So here's this process of life which is moving on. And it would be a little bit strange for us to conclude that we start off life as some kind of absolutely pure, totally innocent creatures with absolutely no tendencies whatsoever. If that was the case, then all of us, without any kind of exception, would be totally shaped by family, by environment, by so-called social circumstances, and that would totally make us up. And therefore, the world that we live in would be the only formative influence. But both from any inquiry into who am I, from any science as well, for that matter, it would appear that we come into this world with particular tendencies. And these tendencies may or may not get stimulated. And some of the unsatisfactory tendencies that we have is, of course, towards neediness, wanting, demanding, expecting. And we can see that with little babies who are not quite so innocent as we love to project them. Those of you who are a father or mother will know rather well if you've got a poor memory. There are those who have a tendency towards being rather negative and agitated, and those towards being anxious, those towards not seeing very well or very clearly, and those in the growth of the child into adulthood towards lots of views and opinions and ideas and obsessional thinking, etc. So here's human beings coming into the situation, and despite the commonality of not planning birth and finding ourselves in this rather large soup of life, there appears to be between us multiple differences. And sometimes it can't be explained. And to give you one small example of what I mean, is a dear friend of mine, a Dharma friend, she has an identical twin sister. And in many, many areas, the two of them, both physically and emotionally and mentally, very, very much alike and share a great deal. And she said, we're identical twin sisters and we were born on different days. I'm not very bright. You know, I left school at 15, so I didn't quite think. Identical twin sisters who have different birthdays. And I said, I don't get it. You can't comprehend it. She says, it's very simple. I'm rather simplistic. It's very simple, Christopher. I was born at 5 minutes to midnight, and my sister was born at 5 minutes past midnight. Hence, we have different birthdays, and my sister was always very upset that her birthday came before the other. And two of the distinguishing features, both sisters are 40 years of age. One, really, 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 really wants a baby. And her husband are thoroughly enjoying themselves in the effort. I hope. And the other sister that I know really, 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 really doesn't want to have a baby. Same parents, loving household, much which is shared in common, and what some might consider important consideration of life. Twin sisters, same parents, same schooling, same class, same upbringing, etc. Lived in the same city in Germany for many, many years, very, very close, both totally clear. One says, I really want, and the other says, I really, really don't want. How does one explain the differences? And of course, both have to trust in the view and how things emerge for both. And I use it as a small example in life. But here we come into this world with our DNA and our genetic background, if you have an Eastern view, what they would call past lives or whatever it might be. And we find ourselves, and then we find ourselves in a world in which there are enormous formative, influential influences. And what we come in with and what arises and comes to us sometimes, as we know, gets hammered into ourselves strongly, daily. And if you and I think of situations in life where somebody approaches us and they say, oh, who are you? What who are you? And the first thing that arises would usually be our name. Oh, I'm Christopher. Sometimes I'm sitting on the dreaded aeroplane, and the passenger who is sitting next to me wants to start a conversation. I generally prefer daydreaming, but anyway, they want to start a conversation. So, and they say, oh, my name is da da da. Then I say, oh, my name is Christopher. And then then who I am is my name. And how could I be my name? The name is just Christopher. It's just a word. So I can't be the word. I can't be Christopher. At least I hope not. And he says, oh, I'm Mary. I'm Mike. I'm Joe. I'm Josephine or whoever it might be. And then the next question would be, what do you do? In my line, it's very difficult. So I usually say, well, I'm an and R for 5 minutes. And I say, well, I'm a teacher. Well, you're a teacher. Oh, do you teach in high school? No. Primary school? No. University? No. Oh, who do you teach? Well, people. And what do you teach? Then I say, meditation. Usually it's the end of conversation. I'm very, which I'm extremely grateful for most times. But then sometimes people have heard about meditation and then will want to ask a little bit about meditation. So who I am ends up as being a name and a meditation teacher. And that's there. Oh, they might talk about the family. Oh, I am a father. I have a daughter. I have three grandchildren. So I'm in the family group, the family constellation, as it is said, and therefore who I am is I am a father, I am a partner, I am a friend, or I am a traveller, or I am a old man rapidly going downhill, or whatever the view might be. So the view is formed, and in the view is formed, this is becomes who I am. And when you and I stop and really give attention to the idea of who I am, this idea, it doesn't seem true. It seems a kind of social agreement. It seems a kind of view which has been given to me. Or something which, very important, is I have identified myself with. And even that view can change. Even with regard to one's name. And so my sister, she said to me, the reason that she got married was so she could change her surname, which is understandable. And I remember when I was a monk, my name got changed. So I went into the monastery as Christopher. I shaved the head. I put on the orange curtains and took ordination. And then my name went from that, from Christopher to Kitty Supo, which is a weird name. And the name means, Kitty means reputation, and Supo means beautiful, the monk with a beautiful reputation. Mildly ironic, I have to say, over the years. But anyway, you never know. And you get so used to identifying with the new name that when one of the missionaries came, as they used to, the Christian ministers came, and trying to convert me, and he said to me, why do you become a Buddhist monk? Why do you become a Buddhist monk? And I had rather a good answer. I said, Jesus sent me. Well, he couldn't do anything with it. It was brilliant. It worked every time. And one of the missionaries came and he said to me, I have a direct telephone line to God. Good, very nice, happy for you. And he said, and the only way you can reach God is through the telephone operator. Wonderful, I'm very happy for you. And the name of the telephone operator is Jesus. And if you telephone Jesus, ask Jesus, he would give you a direct line to God. I said, I'm a Buddhist monk. I don't use telephones. End of story. So sometimes the world looks around at us and it says to us, I want you to be. This is who you are. You are the Son of God. Not the big Son of God, but you know, small. You are the daughter of God. This is who you are. And some of you here will know this. Sometimes we've looked at religion, and I put up today, you see, some concerns about religion and some benefits of religion. And sometimes we look, and sometimes women and men look. And I think understandably one can say religion, the major religions, East and West, I'm not making a difference here, Middle East and Far East and Europe or whatever, tend to be so male-dominated, so strongly male-dominated, many women are saying, and thoughtful men, I just can't connect with it. I can't see why there should be this polarity. I can't see why there should be such power in one gender and so little of it elsewhere. So no thank you. And step out. Yet there is still inquiring going on. There is still questioning going on. There are still deep questions of who am I? What is it to be in this world there? And if the feeling and the sense of the orthodoxy of religion, any of them, I include Buddhism, no exception here, is so much one way inclined, then some, and some of us, including myself, have had to step back from all of that and endeavour to come back to a deep question of who am I? What is it to be in this world and engaging and participating in it? But it's not only religion. One shouldn't underestimate the incredible potency of the nation state. So right from childhood, all over the world, I suppose you have here in Israel, you have these the dreaded flag. Some symbol of something, just a piece of cloth hanging in the wind. It could be a pair of knickers. And it's given such significance. And then one identifies with this and says, oh, I am an Israeli. I am English. Perish the thought. This is who I am. This is who we are. When we took birth, we had no idea of being Israeli or English or American or Arab or whatever. Where did it come from? Where did this word come from that was hammered morning, noon and night into our poor, innocent, rather naive consciousness? Because there's nothing in the cells to show it. There's nothing about the face, the colour, the skin. There's nothing to show an identity of a nationality or of a group of people by anything physical, not by any DNA, not by any genetic background or upbringing or whatever. It totally hinges on the word. The word. There's nothing in the physical or in the mental or in the emotional to determine a nationality. There's no proof of it. It's in the word. The word is not who you are. How could it possibly be? And once that identification for any human being, whoever, wherever, sets in, that I am and the word follows, then there will be those who are not. There will be the other. And the other is another word. And the other word becomes a threat to this word, and then there is conflict, there is hatred, and there is violence. On the word, not on truth, not on reality, not on any scientific inquiry into the human being, not on any meditation on who we are, just on the word. Why? Why are we living like this? Why have we got so identified with a word? And we can look at the responses. We can examine and question them in our side of ourselves. And we say, I want to belong. If I don't have the word, I don't belong. And therefore the word gives me some sense of belonging. I'm a Christian, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a Jew, I'm English, I'm British, I'm Israeli, or Muslim, I'm Arab, or whatever it might be. I have the feeling that I belong. And therefore, I want some security out of the feeling of belonging. Do you all feel marvellously secure? because you belong. When we feel we belong, the actuality is there are many more who have another feeling of belonging, which is to another word. And then you've got two sets, three sets, four sets, five sets, 10 sets of different belongings, all in conflict with each other. Because when we think we belong here, the thought is we do not belong elsewhere. Therefore, conflict. Clinging to a construct. The feeling of belonging and wanting to feel secure. And the hard truth is we feel even more insecure in the belonging because others don't feel they belong. And we feel also in our desire to feel secure, we constantly feel insecure. And it just goes unquestioned. Why? Because we're not questioning, who am I? That's why I say it's a very profound question. I want to read you something. This is the Times newspaper in England, and I'm a fan of big time fan of Bob Dylan, and he's a couple of years older than I am, and ever since his first album in the early 1960s, my relationship to Bob Dylan is like Buddhist to Buddha. And you've probably heard the word obsessive. Obsessive. Well, those of us who are big fans of Bob Dylan, we are called Bobsessives. So I am a dyed-in-the-wool Bobsessive. And years ago, I interviewed Bob Dylan when I was a reporter, another lifetime, I'm going to call it. And in a little while, I'll reach the age of 65, and I've never bothered with birthdays. And really, I'm only interested in the birthless. You know, I've seen what birth is. Birthless is much more interesting. However, I've made an exception. So my dear partner and I, who's a little younger than myself, which is an English understatement, got two Bob Dylan tickets. So the person who is house sitting for me at home just said, "Christopher, your Bob Dylan tickets have just arrived." He's got a new. This is a little bit of free advertising, but he's got a new album coming out. They're on April the 27th, and I'll be in the queue outside the shop. And the new American, this is not too much to do with who am I, you know. I'm just, you know, it's kind of rambling. If you get bored, go to the horizontal posture. So Bob Dylan. Mr. Barack Obama, you know who he is. I don't know if he knows, but anyway, oh, wicked, wicked, wicked. Mr. Barack Obama says he's got 21 songs of Bob Dylan on his iPod. And then Bob Dylan said something rather nice about Barack Obama. You pat my back, I'll pat yours. You know. So Bob's having a slight change of mind. Not too much, but, you know, gracious man. And he said a very lovely thing, that American presidents and people of power, such power, he says, I think it comes from Greek mythology, they get so identified with their position, their role, he said, they fly too close to the sun and get burnt. And he says, when you look at the presidents of the United States, and you know, Prime Minister, now British Prime Minister, I forget his name, that they fly too close to the sun, and as the years go by, they really get burnt. And then so he's not too overly optimistic. And he says, right now, America is in a state of upheaval. Poverty is demoralizing. You can't expect people to have the virtue of purity when they are poor. And then he goes on to speak about the president. And then he touches upon the background of the new president. And I have, if I may say, little interest in this, because my daughter got pregnant at the age of 18, like Barack Obama's mother. And my daughter, with a lovely Caribbean guy, they had a baby at 19. There's now two others there. And my grandson, his name's Kai, actually looks a little bit like Barack Obama. Well, much better looking than him, to be honest. But you know, there. And Dylan said what I, a sweet point about this. He says that change comes not from the great power, yeah, because they fly too close to the wind, so identified with their position, their role, and their power. He says real change in life comes from small groups of people working together. This is the statement. Small groups of people working together can really implement change. And what I notice as one of those people engaged in work with small groups of people, when women and men are willing to be insecure by not holding to an identity tightly, and are willing to take risks, and not to be concerned with the concept of self and who I am, there's a certain freedom which opens itself up, a very, very precious and important freedom. And when people say, this is who I am, the nation state, the religion, the set of beliefs, the family viewpoint, or whatever, when people say, this is who I am, such a person has just stopped their waking up process. Such a person is limited, is finite, and is restricted by their identity. In Dharma teachings, for all that goes on with all of these teachings, is to break free, is to question this whole idea of identity which haunts human beings, and to see if our being and our spirit and our engagement with life can free us up from it. And therefore one can put one's hand on one's heart and says, I am not identified with any word. This is not who I am. I don't know what Dylan's personal life is like. I don't know. But there are, give me another minute with the good man. He wrote this song years ago, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? You know, it's the anthem of the peace movement. Not that it sounds like anybody could have heard it in this country, but anyway, it's the anthem of the peace movement. And then I was at a major exhibition recently, and using the employment of the arts and skills and photography, and another of his songs has been adopted. It's a hard rain that's going to fall. Written some 45 years ago. And it's the words of a prophet. Not only about the acid rain, but the destructions and the wars and children with rifles, teenagers with rifles in their hands and pictures of a desolated environment, etc. And one looks at this song and just sees it's become an anthem of the global movement, of the environmental movement there. And I'd say sometimes with all of this, when we're not caught in a view, in a picture, not caught in an idea of who I am, something in the heart, in the awareness, in the consciousness can open it out and express something really precious and beautiful. I have to let go in order to wake up. I have to let go and take the risks and live in sometimes in that state of uncertainty between who I think I am, question the word or words I'm identified with, and then see what happens to me. Then see what goes on in my life when I haven't got that idea and that belief of who I am. It's a great adventure. The other day, well, the week, a few weeks ago, the lovely, rather delightful soap operas of day-to-day life. A dear friend, who I've known a long time, 25, I've lived in the same forgettable little house in the Totnes in England for 26, 27 years now. So a friend rang me up and said, "Christopher, could we have a latte?" So we're going to have a latte. So he said, "I'm really in a real conflict, a really big conflict." And he says, "I've talked with various people, and I think more or less, sound gone? Okay." So a friend telephoned, said, "Can we have a coffee together?" And over the coffee, he said, "Christopher, I'm in a real conflict. I just don't know what to do." And I said, "Obviously, what it's about?" He said, he's a psychologist, psychotherapist. He's in his early 50s, lovely man, handsome man. He's been married for 30 years. There, he's got a couple of grown-up children. He said, "Christopher, I've fallen in love." And he said, "I'm in a real conflict about it." I said, "How long's it been going on for?" He said, "Well over a year." "Have you told your wife?" "Yes." He said, "She tried for weeks and months to stay with it, and giving me lots of time to try and make up my mind what to do." And he said, "I've spoken to various people, and of course, I'm doing analysis and therapy, and meditating and looking at myself. So I think more or less as a very last resort," he rang Christopher. and I said, "Well, what's the current situation for you?" He said, "My wife threw me out." And he said, "But I can't just go and live with this woman that I've totally fallen in love with, and she's fallen in love with me." So he said, "I'm living in a friend's house. I'm staying there. And the two women are waiting for me to make up my mind." Some of you will know this situation. Good luck. And wicked. And I said to him, he said, my whole life, "I've been really assured I know who I am. I am a happily married man with two children, who works as a psychologist, with a nice home, And he said, I've had a lovely fantasy that in 10, 12 years' time, I'll retire, my wife will retire, and we'll live a nice, quiet, contented old age together. That's a merciless fantasy. And I said, he said, but now everything is uncertain. I don't know what to do. How honest are you? How truthful are you? How clear are you with yourself, with your wife, with your partner? And then while we were talking, I said to him, hey, I just remembered something. We had the same conversation about a woman 20 years ago. He said, how did you know? I said, well, you told me about it. I said, when you were about in your early 30s, you fell in love with a woman and you got into a huge dilemma about it. And then you came to a decision to stay with your wife. He said, Christopher, it's the same woman. He said, she got married. She got divorced a couple of years ago. We reconnected. And after 20 years, all these feelings and love and closeness and intimacy and the sex was as good as ever, and they were back at it. Now he's in this dilemma. And sometimes in talking with people, as he said, which doesn't help. Probably plenty of us hear these stories in our day-to-day life with our friends or with others. Taking the moral view doesn't help. Telling somebody what you should do doesn't help them. Saying to them, if I was in your position, well, you're not. So not only have we got an idea of who I am, we're so arrogant and conceited. We think we know what's best for everybody else. And so this man is still in the dilemma. And the heart and the potency of love as one of the huge forces of life just seems to me, in my listening, and I see also in my own life, has no respect for roles. Just because two people have been together for a long, long time and share much together and look like you're happy suburban couple with 2.2 children, one dog and three cats. The ideal dream, I'm telling you, he said nightmare, would be for some. The ideal dream. And events can go on in life, even to those who have deeply worked on themselves, have really looked into their heart, their feelings, their intentions, their actions, their being in life. And in spite of all of that, and feeling I know who I am, I know my roles, I know my obligations, I know my duties, I know my commitments, and staying true to them with no wish to hurt anybody, not wife, not children, not lover, or whatever it might be. And things move in life and move into consciousness in such a way that the roles and the agreements and the understanding sometimes get blown away, and one is faced with love and the dilemma that can go with it. And he's still struggling with it. I don't want to get back from Israel. I'll give him a call. Where there are decisions, important aspect of this knowing ourselves here. Where there are decisions, the tradition of the Buddha has looked very deeply into all of this to the great credit, and acknowledges that the cognitive, the mind, the decision-making process may not be able to address the inner, the heart, the movement of the love. Sometimes the human being, the way that we are made up, we keep thinking, if I can just think it through, it will then make some shift towards in the heart. We can think till the cows come home. We can still be thinking on our deathbed, and it may not make any real difference. And in the simple analysis which takes place, we think there are all these choices, there are all these decisions. And the Buddha said, in fact, there are only, and no more, four possibilities. And if you can come up with any more, on to you. Four possibilities. Yes. No. Both. Neither. Life is fairly simple. Yes, no, both, or neither. So in his case, it's yes is stay with the wife, and to her tremendous credit, is still very, very patient, loves her husband very, very much, understands it's a dilemma of the heart. No is go, leave his wife, move in with the lady who is wanting and waiting and this renewal from 20 years ago. Both, which is where he is at the moment. Loves one, loves the other, loves one for one reason, set of reasons, loves the other, and is there. And neither would be to step back from both. And he tried that for several weeks. Thought he got clear there, that it was just too painful all around. Went away for several weeks, came back. As soon as he communicated with both, it's all back. And neither also includes not doing anything about it and just see how it unfolds. Yes, no, both, neither. Stay, go, both, neither. There's no other possibilities. And sometimes in the movement of life, in the endeavor to resolve and be clear and know who I am and what I need to do, sometimes we can't resolve. We just can't resolve. And sometimes the self, in a way, has to allow, use Buddhist language for a moment, the dependent arising circumstances to move the life and just to see what unfolds. Sometimes we just can't get the right answer. And we're always wanting to do it right. Life is not that comfortable. He has no idea what will happen. His wife has no idea what will happen. His lover has no idea what will happen. And the two children think he's completely lost the plot. Nobody knows. And sometimes in the movement of life, in the dance of life, in the feelings and thoughts and love and passions and securities and insecurities, it's an enormous challenge because we have to learn to live with this and somehow find a liberation or a freedom which is an authentic reflection of who we really are. In the meditations and in the preciousness of them, it is of course a process, a practice for us to learning to see as clearly as possible. And even though you and I might courageously drop some of these words that we're identified with, our name, our job, our nationality, our religion, background, our family, our ethnic upbringing, or whatever it might be. Though we may see that this is language and words formed together. Very easily, of course, we fall back onto, well, I am a human being. I'm none of that, but I'm a human being. And if you said you weren't, you know, the people in the white coats would be turning up. Except here, of course, it'd be very understandable. So sometimes the who I am, oh, I'm just a human being. But even in that process, the movement of identification is with the idea, I am body and I am mind. This is who I am. And because we speak so much the idea, I am sitting here, body, I am thinking about, I am talking to you, that this then also becomes the box in which we determine ourselves. Dharma practice, sitting on the meditation cushion, standing in meditation, walking in meditation, reclining in meditation, is to see, which is a challenge, that there is body. There is organic life. Just to see that. Rather than say, I am sitting here, or this is my body. There is body. The body sits. There's life in the body. The body is worthy of respect. The body is worthy of care and attention. The body is worthy of sensitivity towards, as well as for others as well. And there is body. There are thoughts. Not I am thinking, there are thoughts. There are feelings which arise. We work with our feelings, our feelings of love, feelings of conflict, our feelings of confusion. And we see there are feelings which are arising. There are emotions which are occurring. There are physical events which are taking place. So the very depth of the willingness to explore who am I doesn't take anything in the perception for granted. And the intentionality behind this, of freeing ourselves up from words and identification with them, freeing ourselves up from roles and identification with them, freeing ourselves up from identification with the feelings, the thoughts and the body, frees the whole life up. And in that freeing of the whole life up, our life moves freely. And it's not so much that we're in any kind of avoidance or denial. We acknowledge the power of the words. We acknowledge the investment that can go with them. We know the stronger the intensity of identification, the greater the other will be. The more I identify with one position or role or group or nation or whatever, the more I identify, the stronger the other will be as well. And it's our exploration in life to explore well and deeply enough that in this profound question of who am I, we free ourselves from the idea of what I thought I was. and something beautiful opens up for human beings, which carries with it an extraordinary sense of belonging in a profoundly different way, because there's no opposite. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings live with deep intimacy with life. May all beings live with a great liberation and a profound sense of belonging. Let's have a quiet minute together. The time now is just 5 past 5, and meditation, or standing and walking, or further sitting if you wish. Tea time would be actually around 6 o'clock. We've made it a little bit later today. Some of the staff, good cooks, said they would like to come to the afternoon talks, and continue with the preparation of the food afterwards, so it'd be a little bit later. So food time will be around 6, so between 6 and 6:15. This hour-long period is for further meditation, sitting, walking, standing, meditation, and also teachers are meeting with some small groups at this time as well.